Chapter 4 Amusements Life in the Clearings versus the Bush by Susanna Moody. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org.
Life hath its pleasures, stern death hath its fears. Joy hath gay laughter, and grief bitter tears. Rejoice with the one, nor shrink from the other. Yon cloud hides the sun, and death is life's brother. As the beam to the day, so the shade to the night. Be certain that heaven orders all for the right.
My dear reader, before we proceed further on our journey, it may be as well to give you some idea of how the Canadian people in towns spend their time. I will endeavour to describe to you the various sources from whence they derive pleasure and amusement. In large cities like Montreal and Toronto, the higher classes are as refined and intellectual as ladies and gentlemen at home, and spend their lives much in the same manner. Their houses abound in all the elegances and luxuries of life, and to step into their drawing-rooms you would imagine yourself still in England. They drive handsome carriages, and ride fine-spirited horses, and if they are encumbered with fewer domestic pests in the shape of pampered servants, they have, in this respect, a decided advantage over their European friends. They dress well and expensively, and are very particular to have their clothes cut in the newest fashion. Men and women adopt the reigning mode so universally that they look all dressed alike. The moment a fashion becomes at all obsolete, the articles of dress made to suit it are discarded. In England, a lady may please herself in the choice of colours, and in adopting as much of a fashion as suited her style of person and taste. But in Canada, they carry this imitation of the fashions of the day to extremes. If green was the prevailing colour, every lady would adopt it, whether it suited her complexion or no. And if she was ever so stout, that circumstances would not prevent her from wearing half a dozen more skirts than was necessary, because that absurd and unhealthy practice has for a long period prevailed. Music is taught very generally, though very few attain any great perfection in the science. A great many perform well enough to gratify their friends and contribute to the enjoyment of a social evening. You will find a piano in every wealthy Canadian's house, and even in the dwellings of most of the respectable mechanics. I have never met with a Canadian girl who could not dance, and dance well. It seems born in them, and it is their favourite amusement. Polkas, waltzes, and quadrilles are the dances most approved in their private and public assemblies. The 8 Scotch reel has, however, its admirers, and most parties end with this lively romping dance. Balls given on public days, such as the Queen's Birthday, and by societies such as the Freemasons, the Odd Fellows, and the Firemen's, are composed of very mixed company, and the highest and lowest are seen in the same room. They generally contrive to keep their own set, dancing alternately, rarely occupying the floor together. It is surprising the goodwill and harmony that presides in these mixed assemblies. As long as they are treated with civility, the lower classes show no lack of courtesy to the higher. To be a spectator at one of these public balls is very amusing. The country girls carry themselves with such an easy freedom that is quite entertaining to look at and listen to them. At a Freemason's ball some years ago, a very amusing thing took place. A young, handsome woman, still in her girlhood, had brought her baby, which she carried with her into the ballroom. On being asked to dance, she was rather puzzled what to do with the child, but, seeing a young lawyer, one of the elite of the town, standing with folded arms, looking on, she ran across the room, and, putting the baby into his arms, exclaimed, "You are not dancing, sir. Pray, hold my baby for me, till the next quadrille is over." Away she skipped back to her partner, and left the gentleman overwhelmed with confusion, while the room shook with peals of laughter. Making the best of it, he danced the baby to the music, and kept it in high good humour till its mother returned. "I guess," she said, "that you are a married man." "Yes," said he, returning the child, "and a mason." "Well, I thought as much, anyhow, by the way you acted with the baby." "My conduct was not quite free from selfishness. I expect a reward." "As how?" that you will give the baby to your husband and dance the next set with me. With all my heart, let us go ahead." If legs did not do their duty, it was no fault of their pretty owner, for she danced with all her strength, greatly to the amusement of her aristocratic partner. When we first came to Belleville, evening parties commenced at the primitive and rational hour of 6 o'clock, but now invitations are issued for 8. The company, however, seldom assembled before 9, and those who wish to be very fashionable don't make their appearance before 10. This is rather absurd in a country, but folly, as well as wisdom, is justified of her children. Evening parties always included dancing and music, while cards are provided for those gentlemen who prefer whist to the society of ladies. The evening generally closes with a splendid supper, in which there is no lack of the good things which the season affords. The ladies are always served first, the gentlemen waiting upon them at supper, and they never sit down to the table, when the company is large, until after the ladies have returned to the drawing-room. This custom would not be very agreeable to some English epicures, but it is an universal one with Canadian gentlemen, whose politeness and attention to the other sex is one of the most pleasing traits in their character. The opportunities of visiting the theatre occur very seldom, and only can be enjoyed by those who reside in the cities of Canada. The young men of the place sometimes get up an amateur performance, in which they act the part of both ladies and gentlemen, greatly to the delight and amusement of their audience. I must say that I have enjoyed a play in one of these private houses more than I ever did at Drury Lane or Covent Garden. The lads act with their whole hearts, and I have seen them shed real tears over the sorrows they were called upon to portray. They did not feign. They really felt the part. Of course, there was little artistic skill, but a good deal of truth and nature. In the summer, riding and boating parties take the place of dancing. These are always regular picnics, each party contributing their share of eatables and drinkables to the general stock. They commonly select some pretty island in the bay, or shady retired spot on the mainland, for the general rendezvous, where they light a fire, boil their kettles, and cook the vegetables to eat with their cold prog, which usually consists of hams, fowls, meat pies, cold joints of meat, and abundance of tarts and cakes, while the luxury of ice is conveyed in a blanket at the bottom of one of the boats. These water parties are very delightful. The ladies stroll about and gather wild fruits and flowers, while the gentlemen fish. The weather at that season of the year is sure to be fine, and the water scenery beautiful in the extreme. Those who possess good voices sing, and the young folks dance on the greensward. A day spent thus, happily with nature in her green domain, is one of pure and innocent enjoyment. There is always a reunion, in the evening of the party, at the house of one of the married ladies who were present at the picnic. In a riding party, some place is selected in the country, and those who are invited meet at a fixed hour on the appointed ground. The Oak Hill Pond, near the village of Rawdon, and about 16 miles from Belleville, is a very favourite spot, and is one of singular beauty. The Oak Hill Pond is a small, clear, and very deep lake on the summit of a high hill. It is about 2 miles in circumference, and being almost circular, must nearly be as broad as it is long. The waters are intensely blue. The background is filled up with groves of dark pine, while the woods in front are composed of the dwarf oaks and firs, which are generally found on these tablelands, interspersed with low bushes. The sandy soil abounding with every Canadian variety of wild fruits and flowers. There is an excellent plank road all the way from Belleville to Rawdon. The Oak Hills lie a little to the left, and you approach them by a very steep ascent, from the summit of which you obtain as fine a prospect as I have seen in this part of Canada. A vast country lies stretched beneath your feet, and you look down upon an immense forest, whose treetops, moved by the wind, cause it to undulate like a green ocean. From this spot you may trace the four windings of the bay to its junction with the blue waters of the Ontario. The last time I gazed from the top of this hill, a thunderstorm was frowning over the woods, and the dense black clouds gave an awful grandeur to the noble picture. The village of Rawdon lies on the other side of this tableland, quite in a valley. A bright, brisk little stream runs through it, and turns several large mills. It is a very pretty rural place, and is fast rising towards the dignity of a town. When we first came to Belleville, the spot on which Rawdon now stands belonged principally, if not altogether, to an enterprising Orkney man, Edward Fidlar, Esquire, to whose energy and industry it mainly owes its existence. Mr. Fidlar might truly be termed the father of the village. A witty friend suggested that instead of Rawdon, it ought more properly to be called Fiddler's Green. There is a clean country inn just at the foot of the long hill leading to the Oak Hill Pond, kept by a respectable widow woman of the name of Fairman. If the picnic party does not wish to be troubled with carrying baskets of provisions so far, they send word to Mrs. Fairman the day previous to prepare dinner for so many guests. This she always does in the best possible country style, at the moderate charge of half a dollar per head. A dinner in the country in Canada, taken at the house of some substantial yeoman, is a very different affair from a dinner in the town. The table literally groans with good cheer, and you cannot offer a greater affront to your hostess than to eat sparingly of the dainties set before you. They like to have several days' warning of your intended visit, that they may go to trouble. As they most truly term, making such magnificent preparations for a few guests. I have sat down to a table of this kind in the country, with only Mr. M. and myself as guests, and we have been served with a dinner that would have amply fed 20 people. Fowls of several sorts, ham, and joints of roast and boiled meat, besides quantities of pies, puddings, custards, and cakes. Cheese is invariably offered to you with apple pie, and several little glass dishes are arranged around your plate for preserves, honey, and applesauce, which latter dainty is never wanting at a country feast. The mistress of the house constantly presses you to partake of all these things, and sometimes the accumulation of rich food on one plate, which it is impossible for you to consume, is everything but agreeable. Two ladies, friends of mine, went to spend the day at one of these two hospitable entertainers. The weather was intensely hot. They had driven a long way in the sun, and both ladies had a headache, and very little appetite in consequence. The mistress of the house went to trouble, and prepared a great feast for her guests. But, finding that they partook very sparingly of her good cheer, her pride was greatly hurt, and rising suddenly from her seat, and turning to them with a stern brow, she exclaimed, "I should like to know what ails my victuals, that you don't choose to eat." The poor ladies explained the reason of their appetites having failed them, but they found it a difficult matter to soothe their irritated hostess, who declared that she would never go to trouble for them again. It is of no use arguing against this amiable weakness, for as eating to uneducated people is one of the greatest enjoyments of life, they cannot imagine how they could make you more comfortable by offering you less food, and of a more simple kind. Large farmers in an old cleared country live remarkably well, and enjoy within themselves all the substantial comforts of life. Many of them keep carriages and drive splendid horses. The contrast between the pork and potato diet, and sometimes of potatoes alone without the pork, in the backwoods, is really striking. Before a gentleman from the old country concludes to settle in the bush, let him first visit these comfortable abodes of peace and plenty. The Honorable R. B., when canvassing the country, paid a round of visits to his principal political supporters, and they literally almost killed him with kindness. Every house provided a feast in honor of their distinguished guest, and he was obliged to eat it all. Coming to spend a quiet evening at our house, the first words he uttered were, "If you have any regard for me, Mrs. M., pray don't ask me to eat. I am sick of the sight of food." I can well imagine the amount of trouble each good wife had taken upon herself on this great occasion. One of the most popular public exhibition is the circus, a sort of travelling Astley's theatre, which belongs to a company in New York. This show visits all the large towns once during the summer season. The performances consist of feats of horsemanship, gymnastics, dancing on the tight and slack rope, and wonderful feats of agility and strength, and to those who have taste and nerve enough to admire such sights, it possesses great attractions. The company is a large one, often exceeding 40 persons. It is provided with good performers and an excellent brass band. The arrival of the circus is commonly announced several weeks before it makes its actual entree in the public papers, and large handbills are posted up in the taverns containing coarse woodcuts of the most exciting scenes in the performance. These ugly pictures draw round them crowds of little boys who know the whole of the program by heart long before the caravans containing the tents and scenery arrive. Hundreds of these little chaps are up before daybreak on the expected morning of the show and walk out to Shannonville, a distance of 9 miles, to meet it. However the farmers may grumble over bad times and low prices, the circus never lacks its quantum of visitors, and there are plenty of half dollars to be had to pay for tickets for themselves and their families. The Indians are particularly fond of this exhibition, and the town is always full of them the day the circus comes in. A large tent is pitched on the open space between the Scotch church and the old hospital, big enough to contain at least 1,000 people, besides a wide area for the performance and the pit. An amphitheatre of seats rise tier above tier to within few feet of the eaves of the tent, for the accommodation of the spectators, and the whole space is lighted by a large chandelier composed of tin holders filled with very bad, greasy tallow candles, that in the close, crowded place emit a very disagreeable odour. The show of horses and feats of horsemanship are always well worth seeing, but the rest grows very tiresome on frequent repetition. Persons must be very fond of this sort of thing who can twice visit the circus, as year after year the clown repeats the same stale jests and shows up the same style of performers. The last time I went in order to please my youngest son, I was more amused by the antics of a man who carried about bullseyes and lemonade than by the actors. Whenever he offered his tray of sweets to the ladies, it was with such an affectedly graceful bend, and throwing into his voice the utmost persuasion, he contrived to glance down on the bullseyes with half an eye, and to gaze up at the ladies he addressed with all that remained of the powers of vision, exclaiming, with his hand on his heart, "How sweet they are!" combining a recommendation of his bullseyes with a compliment to the fair sex. The show opens at 2 o'clock p.m. and again at 7:30 in the evening. The people from a distance and the young children visit the exciting scene during the day, the townspeople at night, as it is less crowded, cooler, and the company more select. Persons of all ranks are there, and the variety of faces and characters that nature exhibits gratis are far more amusing to watch than the feats of the athletes. Then there is Barnum's travelling menagerie of wild animals and of tame darky melodists who occupy a tent by themselves, and a white nigger whom the boys look up upon with the same wonder they would do at a white rat or mouse. Everybody goes to see the wild beasts and to poke fun at the elephants. One man who, born and brought up in the backwoods, had never seen an elephant before, nor even a picture of one, ran half-frightened home to his master, exclaiming, as he bolted into the room, "Oh, sir, sir, you must let the childer go and see the moonjerie. Sure, there's 6 huge critters to be seen, with no eyes and a tail before and behind." The celebrated General Tom Thumb paid the town a visit last summer. His presence was hailed with enthusiastic delight, and people crowded from the most remote settlements to gaze upon the tiny man. One poor Irish woman insisted that he was not a human crather, but a poor fairy changeling, and that he would vanish away some day and never be heard of again. Signor Blitz, the great conjurer, occasionally pays us a visit, but his visits are like angels' visits, few and far between. His performance never fails in filling the large room in the courthouse for several successive nights, and his own purse. Then we have lecturers from the United States on all subjects, who commonly content themselves with hiring the room belonging to the Mechanics Institute, where they hold forth, for the moderate sum of a York shilling a head, on mesmerism, phrenology, biology, phonography, spiritual communications, etc. These wandering lecturers are often very well attended, and their performance is highly entertaining. Imagine a tall, thin, bearded American exhibiting himself at a small wooden desk between two dingy tallow candles, and holding forth in the genuine nasal twang on these half-supernatural sciences on which so much is advanced, and of which so little is at present understood. Our lecturer, however, expresses no doubt upon the subject of which he treats. He proves on the persons of his audience the truth of phrenology, biology, and mesmerism, and the individuals he pitches upon to illustrate his facts perform their part remarkably well, and often leave the spectators in a maze of doubt, astonishment, and admiration. I remember about 3 years ago going with my husband to hear the lectures of a person who called himself Professor R. He had been lecturing for some nights running at the Mechanics Institute for nothing, and had drawn together a great number of persons to hear him, and witnessed the strange things he effected by mesmerism on the persons of such of the audience who wished to test his skill. This would have been but a poor way of getting his living, but these American adventurers never give their time and labor for nothing. He obtained $2 for examining a head phrenologically and drawing out a chart, and as his lectures seldom close without securing him a great many heads for inspection, our disinterested professor contrived to pocket a great deal of money, and to find his cheap lectures an uncommonly profitable speculation. We heard of a great deal of his curing a blacksmith of tic douloureux by mesmerizing him. The blacksmith, though a big, burly man, had turned out an admirable clairvoyant, and by touching particular bumps in his cranium, the professor could make him sing, dance, and fight all in a breath, or transport him to California and set him to picking gold. I was very curious to witness this man's conduct under his alleged mesmeric state, and went accordingly. After a long lecture, during which the professor put into a deep sleep a Kentuckian giant who traveled with him, the blacksmith was called upon to satisfy the curiosity of the spectators. I happened to sit near this individual, and as he rose to comply with the vociferous demands of the audience, I shall never forget the sidelong, knowing glance he cast across the bench to a friend of his own. It was, without exception, the most intelligent telegraphic dispatch that it was possible for one human eye to convey to another, and said more plainly than words could, "You shall see how I can humbug them all." That look opened my eyes completely to the farce that was acting before me, and entering into the spirit of the scene, I must own that I enjoyed it amazingly. The blacksmith was mesmerized by a look alone, and for half an hour went on in a most funny manner, keeping the spectators with their eyes open, and in convulsions of laughter. After a while, the professor left him to enjoy his mesmeric nap, and chose another subject, in the person of a man who had lectured a few nights before on the science of mnemonics, and had been disappointed in a very scanty attendance. After a decent time had elapsed, the new subject yielded very easily to the professor's magic passes, and fell into a profound sleep. The mesmerizer then led him, with his eyes shut, to the front of the stage, and pointed out to the spectators the phrenological development of his head. He then touched the bump of language, and set the seeming automaton talking. But here the professor was caught in his own trap. After once setting him going, he of the mnemonics refused to hold his tongue until he had given to his weary listeners the whole lecture he had delivered a few nights before. He pranced to and fro on the platform, declaiming in the most pedantic voice, and kept us for one blessed hour before he would suffer the professor to deprive him of the unexpected opportunity thus afforded him of being heard. It was a droll scene, the sly blacksmith in a profound fox's sleep, the declaimer pretending to be asleep and wide awake all the time, and the thin, long-faced American too wise to betray his colleagues, but evidently annoyed beyond measure at the trick they had played him. I once went to hear a lecture at the Mechanics' Institute, delivered by a very eccentric person who styled himself the Honorable James Spencer Lidston, the great orator of the West. My astonishment may be guessed better than described when he gave out for the subject of his lecture great women from Eve down to Mrs. M. Not wishing to make myself a laughing-stock to a pretty numerous audience, I left the room. Going up the street the next morning, a venerable, white-haired old man ran after me, and pulling me by the shawl, said, "Mrs. M., why did you leave us last night? He did you justice. Indeed, he did. You should have stayed and heard all the fine things he said of you." Besides scientific lecturers, Canada is visited by singers and musicians of every country, and of every age and sex, from the celebrated Jenny Lind, and the once celebrated Brahm, down to pretenders who can neither sing nor play, worth paying a York shilling to hear. Some of these wandering musicians play with considerable skill, and are persons of talent. Their life is one of strange vicissitudes and adventure, and they have an opportunity of making the acquaintance of many odd characters. In illustration of this, I will give you a few of the trials of a travelling musician, which I took down from the dictation of a young friend, since dead, who earned a precarious living by his profession. He had the faculty of telling his adventures without the power of committing them to paper, and from the simplicity and truthfulness of his character, I have no doubt of the variety of all the amusing anecdotes he told. But he shall speak for himself in the next chapter.
A May Day Carol. There's not a little bird that wings its airy flight on high, in forest bowers, that sweetly sings so blithe in spring as I. I love the fields, the budding flowers, the trees and gushing streams. I bathe my brow in balmy showers, and bask in sunny beams. The wanton wind that fans my cheek, in fancy has a voice, in thrilling tones that gently speak, rejoice with me, rejoice! The bursting of the ocean floods, the silver tinkling rills, the whispering of the waving woods, my inmost bosom fills. The moss for me a carpet weaves, of patterns rich and rare, and meekly through her sheltering leaves the violet nestles there. The violet, oh, what tales of love, of youth's sweet spring are thine, and lovers still, in field and grove, of thee will chaplets twine. Mine are the treasures nature strews with lavish hand around, my precious gems are sparkling dews, my wealth the verdant ground. Mine are the songs that freely gush from hedge and bush and tree, the soaring lark and speckled thrush discourse rich melody. A cloud comes floating o'er the sun, the wood's green glories fade, but hark! The blackbird has begun his wild lay in the shade. He hails with joy the threatened shower, and plumes his glossy wing, while pattering on his leafy bower, I hear the big drops ring. Slowly at first, but quicker now, the rushing rain descends, and to each spray and leafy bough a crown of diamonds lends. Oh! What a splendid sight appears! The sun bursts forth again, and smiling through sweet nature's tears, lights up the hill and plain. And tears are trembling in my eyes, tears of intense delight, whilst gazing upward to the skies, my heart o'erflows my sight. Great God of nature, may thy grace pervade my inmost soul, and in her beauties may I trace the love that formed the whole.
End of chapter 4.